Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who is studying a new surgical technique that allows surgeons to make repairs to the heart without having to open the chest cavity and while the heart is beating. Info at upmcpinnacle.com.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Mention juvenile justice to most people, and they probably don't know much about it, or assume juvenile criminal cases are handled much the same as they are in the adult criminal court. But that's not the case, and there are a lot of differences. Last spring, WITF was given unique access to the juvenile justice system in Cumberland County. Part of that journey will be the subject of the show, Real Life, Real Issues, Juvenile Justice, that airs on WITF-TV tomorrow night at 8:30. We also wanted to revisit our discussions of juvenile justice here on Smart Talk. Joining us, both from Cumberland County, Public Defender Ron Toro and Chief Juvenile Probation Officer Sam Miller. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Good to be here.
We're glad to be here, Scott. Thank you.
If you have a question or comment about juvenile justice, the system in Cumberland County and Pennsylvania overall, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. I want to start with one of the basic questions. What don't people know about juvenile justice here in Pennsylvania?
Well, I guess I'll take a shot at that. I think the biggest difference is that it is really individualized, offender-based. The law does incorporate requirements for victim restoration and obviously community protection that are very similar to the adult system. But I think there's really some distinct differences because, for instance, probation officers, they become involved in the juvenile case prior to reaching any disposition. That's different than the traditional processing in the criminal courts. In the adult criminal courts, mm-hmm. Right. Juvenile probation officers are involved from the onset. They can even be involved when contacted by the police requesting detention or shelter custody for a youth that's that received allegations. So I think the individualized, intimate involvement of the juvenile probation officers with each offender and with each case is distinctly different than what you would see in the adult criminal justice system.
Why is that a positive?
Well, I think it's a positive because it allows that focused attention on the offender and on the specifics of the case. And that would include, what harm the victim has undergone, what the needs of the community are. We're kind of our own court administrator in that we process the case through the system. We're able to see it step by step. We interact with the district attorney, the public defender, defense counsel, as well as the juvenile. And I think that brings out a lot of positives because we learn the case intimately. We learn the details. We develop what I would refer to as a professional alliance with the offenders, and that relationship many times leads to benefits down the road in terms of changing behavior and making the right decisions on what services and treatment are needed for the youth.
Does it work?
My perspective is that it does. Now, it's very easy for the naysayers to point out cases that don't. Because there are plenty. But the greater percentage of youth that enter our system do not reoffend, do not become habitual offenders or recidivists. My perspective is, and the numbers back this up, both statewide and in Cumberland County, that the services put in place do help kids, that kids and their families are benefiting from their contact with the juvenile justice system in Cumberland County, and I believe statewide. And as a result, there's a higher probability or likelihood that they're not going to be adult offenders, that they're not going to progress and eventually be incarcerated. They're going to be productive citizens.
Ron Toro, you're the chief public defender in as far as juveniles are go in Cumberland County. Just as Sam Miller described, this sounds like a team effort. I mean, our court system, it's an adversarial system. I mean, most of us get our ideas from how it works from TV or movies or something like that. There, we have a prosecutor, we have a defense attorney. They're always at each other's throats, and it's, you know, high drama and all that. But from what Sam is describing, you're part of the team that is trying to work this out, working with the DA, working with the prosecutors, working with the probation officers to try to come to some kind of conclusion.
Absolutely, Scott. And in fact, it's interesting because just you asked about some of the differences, and that is one of the differences. We are, in fact, an adversarial system in the juvenile world. However, we do work together to find an appropriate resolution for each child that comes in. One of the other things that is very different about our system, as Sam mentioned, right on the front end, juvenile probation gets involved. So I'm getting calls from parents all the time saying, I don't understand why I need to go in and talk to these guys when, in fact, my child hasn't been convicted of anything. The reality is that's the law. And we involve families right on the front end because we understand that you don't just fix a child. You have to work with an entire family. So it is a collaborative effort. The district attorney is involved with seeking a fair resolution. I'm involved with helping the kid migrate the system. Probation's involved in, you know, providing the services that are necessary. So we work together, and we have consistently come up with good resolutions for our kids and their families.
If it is so successful, why don't we do it in adult court?
Well, it's very different in adult court in that we are completely offender and offense-focused in the adult world. We deal with adult defendants to punish, to provide, there's certainly rehabilitation services provided, but the focus is on the offender and the offense, and I hate to say it, it's focused primarily on punishment. Our juvenile system is not focused on punishment at all. Even kids that end up being placed into detention or into a long-term facility are there for competency development. We're trying to find ways to, as Sam mentioned, to keep them from becoming adult defendants. Could the adult world change that way? I don't know, but fortunately the juvenile world is that way. And again, we've been very successful. As Sam mentioned, the statistics point out our recidivism rate is very, very low. And if you can find a young person and deal with them and their issues early on, they're not going to come back and go into our adult system.
Obviously, there are a few differences. I mean, you mentioned families. Most adult offenders don't have their mother or their father with them when they're going into the court system. And I'm obviously, that is a big difference. But at the same time, when you say that the emphasis is on punishment in the adult system, you get the sense, and Sam, I'll point this to you, you get the sense that the philosophy is that, okay, these are young people. We still can save their lives and make them realize they made a mistake and rehabilitate them or whatever you have to do to keep them from hurting anyone else, offending, you know, breaking the law again. Where with the adult courts, it's, as you know, Ron said, it's more on, okay, you broke the law, you should know better, you're an adult, you're going to jail.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think it was a good point, and I agree with what Ron said. But I do want to kind of put in a good word for what's happening in the adult system and the people I know that are working there.
I didn't want to disparage them at all. I'm just saying that there are differences.
Well, I think there are. I think volume is number one. They're dealing with the significantly higher numbers of offenders than in the juvenile system. And number two, I think you're seeing a transition in the adult system where many of the jurisdictions are operating specialized courts, whether they're drug courts responding to the opioid crisis or veterans courts or things of that nature, I think are really providing somewhat of the same specialized, individualized focus that you see in the juvenile system. But one of the things that I think you said that I really do need to comment on that I agree with is this whole concept, and there's been a lot of recent court decisions, including up to the U.S. Supreme Court, on how juvenile offenders are different than adult offenders. Adolescent brain development is really significantly different, and the front part of the brain that is developing up until probably age 24 that helps in terms of making judgments and being able to see long-term consequences or the results of your action, it's not fully developed in kids as it is as it would be for a 30-year-old adult offender. That does make it different. That does have an impact on the court's decisions in terms of how they look at offenders, because they realize a lot of these kids are still growing up. Their brains are still developing. They don't give them a pass. There is accountability that needs to be a part of the final decision. But they certainly have to take into consideration that they're exactly what you said. They're still developing in terms of both their physical aspects of their body as well as their brain.
And again, I want to repeat, just clarify, I was not disparaging the adult courts, because obviously there has been some good news. I mean, just earlier this week, the Wolf administration announced that the state prison population is down. Crime rates have gone down across the country for the past 20 years or so. We are looking at crime a little bit differently. Just wanted to point that out with the adult system, but juvenile is different. Obviously, as you said, it is not perfect. When there is a juvenile who goes on to, a life of crime or to offend as an adult, Ron, what didn't they learn if they offended as a juvenile? What didn't they learn? What didn't they take advantage of in the juvenile system?
Well, that's a great question. And again, because of our individualized approach, it's going to vary from kid to kid. We have children that come out of our services, go back into families that are dysfunctional. We can't fix families necessarily. We try the best we can to provide services and assistance. Sometimes these kids just don't have a support system. And, you know, they go back to self-medicating by using drugs. They get in with the wrong peers. We see that a lot. It is not unusual in our world to see 2, 3, 4 kids offending together. We get multiple cases where kids are running together and doing things. So they just fall into the wrong crowd, and we can't fix every single kid that comes through our system. We do our damnedest to try to, and fix is the wrong word, but you provide all the services you can, all that the kids will take advantage of, all the families will take advantage of. But sometimes just it ain't going to work. And that's, I think Sam would agree with me on that. We do our best. And, like I said, you can't change the physical environment sometimes that the kids are in. But fortunately, again, that's such a small portion of the kids that come through our system. Again, even if you look at a recidivism rate, a kid might make a second mistake, and that's going to be part of a new offense. That doesn't mean that all of a sudden that kid's going to become a lifetime criminal. Adults make multiple mistakes too. So the percentage of our kids that I think that go on to be hard adult criminals is very, very low. So we've been very fortunate and happy about that.
How important is family?
Oh, it's extraordinarily important. We've come to the conclusion, I think, and I think Sam and I have grown up with this together over the last 20 years, that dealing with families and family issues, juvenile probation is very good at putting in-home family services in place. It is not unusual for us to find issues within the families that have led to, the offender doing what he or she did. So we work very hard to work with families, and putting those dollars and resources into helping that family become better capable of dealing with their issues has paid great rewards to our community.
Sam, I'm curious, when Ron talks about maybe hanging out with the wrong crowd or getting involved in you know, substance abuse or something like that. As a probation officer, do you ever, and I don't even mean legally you can do anything like this, but I'm just curious, do you ever say to an offender, you got to stay away from this guy, that crowd? You ever give them that kind of advice that here's part of your problem?
Yeah, we actually, and I know you're aware of this, but I'll repeat it. We do an assessment on every youth that is referred to our office. It's an evidence-based assessment, and it's broken down into categories, and one of the categories is called peer relations. And peer relations actually evaluates whether a youth's high risk, moderate risk, or low risk based on who they run around with. So it is something we address. It is something that obviously plays a major role in the youth's life. You know, we are what we do and who we hang out with and things of that nature. I also think one thing I do want to add, one of the prominent things we see that determines or that drives youthful offender behavior is trauma. Many of the youth that are referred into our office, they've gone through something significant, just like a returning veteran from overseas that may be suffering from PTSD. Many of these youth have PTSD because of trauma they've seen in the home or maybe even outside the home, whether it's violence, abuse, or neglect. There's also other issues associated with that, such as mental health. We've seen a real increase in mental health. And by mental health, I want to include things such as depression, concerns about suicide, things of that nature. Those are real prevalent issues with youth in today's society. And obviously, they're a big part of the kids we deal with.
And let me just plug the second portion of our show. We're going to be talking with the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania about some of the priorities, and a few of the issues you just ticked off are some of the priorities that the counties are looking at across the state. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who has offered transapical mitral valve repair procedures for more than 3 years and currently serves as a trial site for over 50 clinical trials. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
We're discussing juvenile justice here in Pennsylvania with our guest, Cumberland County Public Defender, Juvenile Public Defender Ron Turo, Cumberland County Chief Juvenile Probation Officer Sam Miller. And we're bringing someone else in just a moment who has been there, gone through the system in just a few minutes. This is all ahead of a TV program tomorrow night on WITF-TV, Real Life, Real Issues, Juvenile Justice. It airs on WITF-TV tomorrow night at 8:30. So a lot of what you're learning here today, we'll follow up on that, and you get to follow someone through the system tomorrow night during that program, so be sure to tune in. Our phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Gentlemen, we talked about success stories, and it's good to hear that there are a lot of success stories. But Ron Turo, one of the things that Cumberland County does is actually recognize some of those success stories with a scholarship, the Hoffer Second Chance Scholarship. Tell me about that.
The Honorable George E. Hoffer Second Chance Memorial Scholarship was created by our former president judge, George Hoffer, and juvenile court judge, George Hoffer's wife, Ann Hoffer. As a memorial to George, George was passionate about working with kids, and he saw that many of these kids that came through our system did not have an opportunity to go to college to basically learn from the issues like we talked about before. They didn't have the resources that you know, some other kids had. So Mrs. Hoffer created this scholarship, has funded it almost completely by herself. And we now provide scholarships to young men and young women who have successfully come out of our juvenile justice system. And if they are accepted into college, we will follow them for 4 years of their college journey. And as long as they continue to maintain good grades, stay out of trouble, They can earn up to $10,000 in scholarship help from our scholarship foundation, which is completely controlled now and run by the Cumberland County Bar Foundation.
Well, one of those scholarship recipients is with us today, Adam. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to be here, Scott.
You are going to college, right?
Yes.
What are you majoring in?
Business.
Business. But you did go through the juvenile justice system in Cumberland County. Tell me a little bit about what happened, what led to you getting involved in the system.
Not really much of a long story. I was in high school. We all been there. We all know what it's like to be young. Made some mistakes that I regret, and while they happened, I'm not dwelling on them. I'm looking past it. I got in trouble, was put on, they don't know if they mentioned it, it's called the Youth Aid Panel, which is the first step, and it's kind of like where you're just getting introduced to it, where you're not like a repeat offender. However, I didn't learn my lesson and made a second mistake. However, after that time, I got my act together. I'm pretty sure within like a week or two of getting in trouble again, I applied at college within a week or two, I'm pretty sure. And then just from that point on, I was just like, I need to change my point in my life, and I need to move towards a better future for myself than what I want to be.
Did you always want to go to college?
I always wanted to go to college, and I always told myself I was going to go to college. I just didn't have like that motivation, or didn't like, just nothing really caught me there. I was just kind of like, oh, I'll get there when I get there. But now having the scholarship helps me stay motivated to keep working, because I know I have the people behind me. I have people that are supporting me, not only just my family, but the people that see me or want to see me do well, that recognize that, yeah, I made these mistakes in my past, but they still support me and they still don't think I'm a bad person because of it. They know that I'm still a human being and everybody makes mistakes, but we can still be successful in life even though we make these mistakes.
And I don't want to pry too much, because I don't want to, whatever you want to talk about, but I mean, these mistakes that you made, I mean, you broke the law?
Yes. They were drug related.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this was while you were a senior in high school. What kind of grades were you getting in high school?
I wasn't getting terribly awful grades. I mean, they were just like your C's and B's. I mean, I was getting by. Like, I'll get the occasional A. I mean, I wasn't really put too much effort in. I kind of just, like, it's high school. I was just kind of going along with it, and I'd say my definitely mental aspect of that changed, especially now I'm in college, because like, I'm paying for this. I'm getting and paying for my education, or I'm having people that are paying for this. I'm not just going to go with the flow. I'm not just going to goof off. I want to actually get a good education. I want to get my stuff together. I want to get my life in order. I want to be educated. I don't want to just live my life not wondering what I'm doing, mm-hmm, and just kind of going around.
So when you got involved in the system, and you mentioned that you were part of the Youth Aid Panel, we're going to talk about that in just a moment, in Cumberland County, but what did you get out of the system, and what did you get? You know, both Sam and Ron have been talking about working one-on-one, working with families. What did you get out of it? Was there an aha moment when it struck you that I screwed up and I'm going to have to follow this if I want to get my life back together again?
Well, I'd say probably I was the first time I got on the Youth Aid Panel, and that was, I understood I got in trouble, but at the same time, the severity of the events didn't really set in for me yet, and I was still making these stupid decisions. And then after that happened,
so did you kind of fight it? I mean, like, did you take responsibility for it, or did you say, well, you know, I got caught?
At first I kind of fought it, not gonna lie, I'm gonna be honest, I kind of fought it at first, but however, then I realized that that's not where I wanted to be with my life, or not where I wanted to go, and was at the one point, I think it wasn't when I got in trouble, it was close to that point, but then getting in trouble again kind of just kicked me to that point where it's just like, you know what, you need to cut this crap out and just get your life on the direction that it's supposed to be.
So what about going through the system, what in particular struck you that helped you get on the right path?
I'd just say probably the support system, honestly. It wasn't just people say, oh, the system is against you, oh, they hate you, or they just want to see you fail. And while that It's not the case. You're gonna have the people that are gonna fight it, like they mentioned, and they're, it's not gonna help if you don't want to get better. You're not gonna get better if you don't want to get better. But I'd say it's a constant support system. Like I've always, even how I said I got in trouble, even like I was still with, I had two different probation officers during my time, and my original one was still in contact with me. He was actually the one that brought up the scholarship and mentioned it with it. He still cared about me and seeing me succeed, even though he wasn't really much involved with me anymore, as much involved with me as he was before.
Well, Adam, congratulations on getting your life together. I mean, you seem, I mean, I've just met you, but you seem pretty happy right now and satisfied where your life is. And it sounds as if you got the support you need. What about from family? Did you get the support?
Yeah, definitely. They said definitely family support is a big thing. My family has always been behind me. They've always been behind me even before I got in trouble. And definitely having them there, like they said, I can definitely see why someone that wouldn't have a support system can just fall and crumble and just like fall away and not really try to get better, because it was a stressful time. It was a lot, and my family definitely helped me through it a lot, talking to it. They were always there to talk to me whenever I felt stressed out or not really sure what to do. They were always there saying, hey, it happened. You can't change it, but you got to move past it. They were always there and constantly just telling me to just keep moving forward and keep pushing, and I can't thank him enough for that.
So, Sam, that has to make you feel at least satisfied, make you feel good that you hear stories like that, and I assume that there are a lot of other stories like that.
Yeah, it does make me feel good. I'm sitting here beside Adam, and I'm very interested, because I know the probation officers he's talking about that reached out to him, and it's the way the system should work. I do want to say that we have many successes that really make our day and keep us going. The Youth Aid Panel is a big part of that. Any successful juvenile justice system anywhere in any jurisdiction is going to have a good diversion program, and that's what the Youth Aid Panel program does in Cumberland County.
Yeah, we actually had someone who called in and wondered about the role of volunteers. Are there volunteers involved in that?
Yeah, actually, the Youth Aid Panel is all about community volunteers throughout the county, and my numbers might be off a little bit, but there's probably somewhere between 60 and 70 adult citizen volunteers that sit on panels in the jurisdictions throughout Cumberland County, and they hear cases of youth who have been referred to the probation office, and they put together contracts for that youth after speaking with them to make amends. It could be restitution. It could be random acts of kindness. It could be community service.
Yeah, see, victims was that, you know, you're touching on victims, and that's one thing I wanted to ask about, is because, you know, it's a good thing to help these young people and help them on their way to, you know, steer them on the right path. But what about victims?
Well, let me just say about that, because it's important to understand that. Victims have a right in Pennsylvania to participate in all aspects of an offender's court hearings, treatment, etc. We have a full-time victim advocate in Cumberland County. All these victims are informed of what's going on. And restitution, as Sam knows and Sam has pursued, is very important. And we have a very, very good track record of collecting restitution for victims. In many cases, victims will come into court and be there during different proceedings for these juvenile offenders. So victims have become much more involved in our system, and that's a positive thing, because that's part of the whole redemptive process that we go through. Offenders need to understand that what they did had a serious impact on another person, and it can be as simple as a drug case. So we really emphasize making sure that victims are informed and involved and hopefully rehabilitated themselves.
Got a question from a listener. If the brain isn't fully developed until age 24, why are 18 to 24-year-olds adjudicated in adult court?
Well, I think that's a question she could probably take to our legislators, and might be above my pay grade, but I think it's a reasonable question. I think that if you look across the nation in different states, you will see varying degrees of what I'll call age of majority. In New York, for example, I believe that once you're 16 or maybe 17, you're an adult offender. And it's that way in some states. So it does vary. There are different perspectives on that. My perspective is that the adult courts do try to take it into account. There is mitigation brought to light in adult offenses also. One of the things I didn't mention when we were speaking briefly about some of the advances in adult court is I know in Cumberland County they've just started a mental health court that's done in a number of jurisdictions. So I think that the individual mitigating circumstances, including age, is taken into account in a variety of programs in adult court. It's just, it's a greater challenge, quite frankly, because of the volume they experience.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Cumberland County Chief Public Defender, Juvenile Public Defender Ron Turo, Cumberland County Chief Juvenile Probation Officer Sam Miller, and Adam, recipient of the Hoffer Second Chance Scholarship. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
And I should mention again that the TV program Real Life, Real Issues, Juvenile Justice airs tomorrow night on WITF-TV at 8:30. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania's 67 counties have a lot of people telling them what to do, but often don't have the resources, meaning money, to do what they're told. In other words, counties are charged with implementing much of what state government mandates, but sometimes counties don't have a way to generate revenue to pay for it. It brings up a lot of issues. Counties have their own set of priorities in 2018, and that's what we want to discuss here in the second portion of today's program with Douglas Hill, Executive Director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. Doug, good to see you again.
Great to be with you.
Also joining us is Lancaster County Commissioner Dennis Stuckey, who is President of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. Commissioner Stuckey, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org, and you'll see that there are some common themes about what we've just discussed with juvenile justice and what counties are doing on that level and in that issue, and maybe some of the things that we're talking about here with the counties. You know, Doug, I mentioned to you before the show that one of the reasons that I do like having the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania on the program, well, first of all, it's always a good conversation, but sometimes I feel like counties get left behind when they may be the closest local government to many Pennsylvania citizens out there, but there's so much focus on state government, there's so much focus on what's coming out of Washington, that sometimes people aren't paying as much attention to Lancaster, York, Lebanon, Harrisburg, what is happening in the counties.
Well, and we agree, and we appreciate the opportunity to be with you, because the breadth of services that we provide is something that I don't think the public always understands. I think our priorities this year reflect that. So we're talking about human service, criminal justice issues, elections, economic development, and the list goes on.
And we're going to talk about each one of those. Commissioner Stuckey, as president of the association, you're thinking about all 67 counties, but in Lancaster County, one of the most populated counties in the state, and probably when many people look at Lancaster County, they think, okay, here's a county that is doing very well. But you still, even though a county that is doing very well, are dealing with many of the issues that even some of the smallest counties, even some of the counties that have the least amount of resources are dealing with, correct?
That's correct. Budgets are always a challenge for even for Lancaster County, trying to allocate resources for the different services we have to provide, whether it's courts, prisons, children and youth, through the mandates from the Commonwealth, Office of Aging, Veterans Affairs. So, you know, there's just not an unlimited amount of money that's available from the taxpayer's pocket to provide all those services. So we have to manage very closely, and we manage conservatively in Lancaster County.
Okay, when you talk about just not an unlimited amount of money, no government has an unlimited amount of money, but counties in particular, and I won't go as far as saying municipalities, local municipalities as well. In Pennsylvania, you have a real challenge in that you only have so many ways to generate revenue, and that's one of the things that you're looking at. Isn't that true?
That's correct.
Trying to find other ways other than the property tax fees. That, what would you have in mind?
We only have the property tax to generate revenue. Now, there are other fees and fines and some costs or some money that flows through the different offices, row offices, or the courts, but primarily it's property tax. So we have to be very careful when we set the millage rate. Lancaster County just went through reassessment last year. It's our third in the last 20 years. We were able to set the neutral millage rate and keep it for the next year, for 2018, which means that in the aggregate, Lancaster County did not get any more tax revenue from their taxpayers, county taxpayers, in 2018 than they got in 2017.
Doug Hill, we've talked about this many times on this program, but that is a real issue when you are limited as to how you can generate revenue at the same time when you have the state legislature telling you, oh, by the way, counties, you need to do this.
Well, we are looking for alternate tax bases, certainly. Both the income tax and the sales tax, as they're structured in Pennsylvania, are more progressive or more fair. And so we would like to have those as options as well.
But no one likes to hear that we'd like, because, for example, Philadelphia and Allegheny counties do have a sales tax that is higher than the state's 6% sales tax. No taxpayer out there likes to hear that you're looking for alternative tax ways to raise, to generate taxes, let me put it that way, to generate revenue, because what they do here is just the word that I almost slipped on, is they hear tax increase.
Right, and we don't levy taxes just to get more money. We don't, when a county structures a budget, it doesn't say, okay, now here's how much money, what should we spend it on? We look first at what we're required to provide, what the legislature requires us to provide, the courts, and then what the citizens demand. And then we see, is the revenue that we have available enough to meet those service needs? I should mention, too, you know, the voters approved a constitutional amendment in November that allows a broader homestead exclusion. And that's something that we would like to take advantage of as well. But interestingly, the Constitution also says you can't use a property tax to put in place the exclusion. And so if the counties are to take advantage of the exclusion and give our residential property owners that exemption, we need an alternate tax base to be able to do that. So the bottom line is we're not looking at alternate tax bases to raise revenue. We're looking at it to provide more fair means by which we raise revenue.
And just to be clear, and this kind of relates to the property tax debate overall, if you will, you know, the discussions about eliminating property taxes, mostly they're talking about school districts, but still the proposals to eliminate property taxes, those taxes, property taxes would go down and an income tax or a sales tax would replace it, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And something else I just mentioned, this kind of goes back to my first question of a lot of people not thinking about counties. When people hear property taxes, they almost automatically think about their school districts. Well, let's face it, part of that is because their school taxes are much higher than their property taxes for the county. But that must present a bit of a challenge to you, too, because almost all the property tax discussion is about school districts.
It is particularly frustrating, yes, because the schools also have an income tax base that's accessible to them, and for many of the schools, that's a large percentage of their income. And again, for the counties, anytime legislative appropriations aren't sufficient to meet our service mandates, the only option we have is to raise the property tax.
You mentioned right off the bat human service funding and system reform. Again, counties are told that you will be implementing many of these human service programs. And today, while we're having this opioid crisis in the midst of it, counties are on the front lines of that. So what in particular are you looking for?
What we're looking for is a fair level of funding for the services that we're required to provide. About 90% of counties' expenditures are the direct result of state or federal mandate. And of those, probably almost half is human services. A large percentage of it is criminal justice. But what we need is for the state to step up and pay their fair share. But I'll mention as well, another of our priorities this year is to deal with mandates in the broader context. And contrary to what most people would think, we don't oppose mandates. Rather, because I think most counties agree, here's a set of services that the public needs, and we're probably the best level of government, best equipped to provide those services. And so what we're trying to do is reinvigorate the notion of a partnership with the Commonwealth, We're serving the same citizens. We are dealing with the same set of taxpayers. And so if the Commonwealth is saying we need to provide these services, then the Commonwealth also needs to pay a fair and equitable share.
So what you do oppose is unfunded mandates.
Unfunded mandates, right. If there is something else that counties should undertake, or if we are going to expand an existing service, as we did a couple years ago in children and youth, the proportionate share of state funding needs to be a part of that discussion.
You said children and youth. Give me an example of an unfunded mandate that counties are dealing with and have a hard time dealing with.
Sure. Well, with the unfortunate circumstances with the Sandusky matter, there were close to 30 different new laws put in place to tighten up the services for abused or potentially abused children. One of those was a whole group of people now became mandatory reporters. In other words, if they saw something that they weren't sure of, they had to report to the county. And what that did was to increase county caseloads for children and youth somewhere between 30 and in some cases 100%. And so that is a direct cost that the counties now bear, but there was no additional state funding to accompany that.
Commissioner Stuckey, I know that your county is dealing with that issue in particular, but the opioid crisis that we focus on almost every day, we hear something different about it. Lancaster County, one of those counties across the state that has had an increased number of opioid overdoses. What are you looking for when you talk about priorities in dealing with the opioid crisis on the county level? What are you looking for?
Well, we have one effort that's going on locally. It's called Coming Together. Commissioner Parsons is spearheading that, but it's resources, it's commitment, it's partners to work with to address this issue. We went from 85 deaths several years ago. Last year was 117. It was 117 2 years ago. It was 165 last year. This is a real problem. People are dying. So getting the resources and the plan set forward to address this issue, and it is a state issue, it's a local issue, it's a county issue, it's a national issue. We all need help. We all need to work together. And one of the things that we, as Doug mentioned, we're trying to work with our legislatures to be their partners in addressing this. The governor came out with his declaration
declared
emergency, and we supported that. So it's a problem that is insidious. It is dangerous. It is very difficult to address in any meaningful way. I've been supportive of the governor's declaration. I've been supportive of the local effort to bring groups together that can address this issue, whether it's treatment, whether it's prevention. Treatment is hard because this is very powerful stuff. And once you get hooked, once you get addicted, it's very, very difficult. 3 days before Christmas, my son's nephew through marriage passed away. Been battling this addiction for 8 years, went through rehab 8 times, and still was hooked on it and still took his life.
When you say resources, what you mean is money. Are you talking about resources, money from the state, and how would counties use that money when it comes to, I mean, you listed treatment, you listed prevention. How would counties use that money if it was coming from the state?
Well, it could be a different means. We could do it ourselves through our single county authority or the Drug and Alcohol Commission that we have, whether it's expanded resources for treatment or prevention, or we could do it through community groups such as Commissioner Parsons bringing together in Lancaster County. How that funding comes through, we need a plan to address the issues and then determine from the Commonwealth and the counties what resources are available.
Let's take a phone call from Liv in Carlisle. Liv, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to offer an alternative to Scott's statement about, no taxpayer wants to hear about increased taxes. I would be fine with that if what that means is that we are offering more prevention and rehabilitation. All the programs that I think that government has a responsibility to provide for a healthy community, for healthy futures for our kids, if it means going to better public schools, I'm all for it. So it's not a universal taxpayers don't like increased taxes. if it's going to the right thing, it's important, and I would do it, and I would happily do so. Every ounce or every penny that we put into prevention means that we're saving money on the other side. Mm. So it's really good for all of us if we can fund these kinds of programs even more so.
Liv, thank you very much for your call. And there may be other people out there, but we do know that there are a lot of people who don't want to hear anything about increased taxes. But, I mean, Liv has a very thoughtful observation there that the reality is that a lot of these things have to be dealt with and counties mm-hmm. have to deal with them. I want to turn to another one of your priorities, Doug Hill, maintaining the shale gas impact fee. This is something that has worked quite well. The impact fee has for those counties where natural gas is drilled. For the most part, the idea behind it was to maintain roads and the services the counties would put out. I don't know how many counties have actually benefited from the impact fee, but this is different than what has been debated in the legislature the last few years, and that is a severance fee. Severance tax. There are a lot of people who are pushing for a severance tax on natural gas drilling, and would be, you know, the money would go to any number, education, you know, the general fund budget, whatever it would go for. So I want to find out where you stand as far as severance fee versus a severance tax.
Okay. Well, the severance tax would be used by the Commonwealth to augment revenues coming into the general fund. We don't have a position on it per se. But again, the availability of funds in the general fund also affects what the legislature is able to appropriate to us. So that should be part of the discussion. Our particular interest, though, in the impact fee is that, as you say, it's been tremendously beneficial for the 30-some counties that are the hosts to shale gas wells. But it's also been a benefit to the rest of the counties because a piece of that goes through the state and back out to all counties statewide for environmental and infrastructure purposes. So our position is to be certain that if the severance tax is put in place, that it does not affect either the rate or the method of distribution of the impact fee.
So if a severance tax was put in place, those counties that benefit from the impact fee would not want to hear, okay, this is going to replace, you're going to get some money back, but it's going to come from Harrisburg, be divided up somehow, some way other than what an impact fee and specific items, right?
That's correct, yes. And so far, the legislation that's been under consideration does credit off what a company pays for the impact fee against what they would pay the state for a severance tax, bottom line being, the legislation considered to date does preserve the shale gas impact fee in a way that we're supporting.
Commissioner Stuck, I'm curious. Lancaster County is not one of those counties where natural gas is drilled, but as Doug said, all counties are benefiting from this. Do you ever have constituents, Lancaster Countyans, who say, hey, you know, we'd like to have a severance tax so we could benefit from this too?
We benefit tremendously from the impact fee in Lancaster County, because even though we do not have shale gas or wells drilled, the legacy piece for open spaces we've used in different methodologies. That's you can apply it very broadly. We've used it for agriculture preserve to provide matching funds to our farmland trust group to help preserve farmland in Lancaster County. The infrastructure piece that Doug mentioned has been a real plus for us in rehabbing bridges. It's accelerated our bridge maintenance program by about 2 to 3 years in addressing structurally deficient bridges. So that impact fee is very important to Lancaster County and all counties, both from the legacy piece for open space and the infrastructure, particularly the infrastructure if you have bridges, which counties in Pennsylvania own a lot of bridges. So we're in the same boat as the Commonwealth trying to address structurally deficient bridges, and that has been very, very helpful.
One of the issues that many counties are dealing with in their county prisons is the high percentage of inmates in those prisons who have been diagnosed or could be diagnosed as having a mental illness. Commissioner Stuckey, is this an issue in Lancaster County, and what are you looking for, the county commissioners, the counties across the state, what are you looking for so that those people get treatment rather than end up in the county prison?
It is a tragedy to have those with mental illness end up in a prison, and many times they just act out what is natural to them and run afoul of police, of the justice system, and end up in prison. It's a tragedy when that's where they become residents. We are fortunate in Lancaster County in that Penn Medicine, Lancaster General Health, is building a mental health hospital, which we will have some beds that we can send inmates to who need mental health treatment. Not all counties have that. It is a problem for a lot of counties. And when you are trying to move a mental health patient out who has no business being in your prison, incarcerated, finding beds, finding space is a challenge for many of our counties, and we all face it. It's everywhere. It's in 67 counties having to deal with mental health issues on the street when they get into the justice system and into our prisons. It's a problem for all of us.
I wish we had more time to talk about that in particular. We only have about a minute or so left. Doug Hill, one thing I definitely wanted to touch on was voting. We have a big election coming up this year for members of Congress. We don't know what districts they'll be in yet, but members of Congress, also state legislature, half the state Senate. But there are counties when, there's been questions about how secure it is. What do counties need when it comes to voting? I have about 30 seconds left. Okay.
Well, very quickly, our systems are secure. They don't interface with the internet in any way. So they are secure.
That's
People
good.
Don't have to worry about how their votes being accurately counted. But the equipment we have in place is dated back to about 2006 in almost all counties. The technology is old. The equipment itself is aging. And so we do need to begin a program of replacement statewide. The difficult part is that's going to be well over $100 million statewide to be able to do it and do it properly.
Mm. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Douglas Hill is the Executive Director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. Lancaster County Commissioner Dennis Stuckey, President of the Association. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Wonderful to be with you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, Katie Meyer fills in talking about that court ruling, Supreme Court ruling, having to do with redistricting.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle. Its 11 principal investigators and 12 nurse coordinators conduct research efforts to advance cardiovascular medicine. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.